miss you when I
Welcome back, everyone. For today, I'm actually here to discuss Jerry Horn with Dr. Hawk of Chopping Wood Inside. And before we dive into it, I'll hand over the mic so he can introduce himself further.
Just a little side note on Dr. Hawk. Hawk came from the movie Ishtar, the great 1987 classic. Me and Murphy, the co-host of Chopping Wood Inside, we call each other Hawk and Lyle when we started the podcast, Chopping Wood Inside. What did we call each other? I can't just Hawk or whatever. So he came up with Dr. Hawk. It stuck. My name's Tom, but call me Dr. Hawk. So we did the Chopping Wood Inside podcast just to discuss the wonderful world of Twin Peaks. We met a lot of wonderful people. We stopped doing the show because we didn't have anything else to talk about. But Colin was gracious to ask me onto his show to talk about the great Jerry Horn. So I thank him for that.
And I think the best place to start off with Jerry Horn is actually in his early days with Luis Dombrowski, because I think of that scene in season two when Jerry and Ben, when they're just reminiscing about their older memories, and I think of the allure that she had on him and Ben, because there's nothing that's like necessarily sexual about it, but I just get the feeling of like the way that scene is conveyed, that this is kind of like what sets a tone for them onward. Did you have any thoughts about Luis Dombrowski or any of those points?
I think you're correct.
There's got to be like a sexual component, because that's such a huge component of their characters in season one and season two. Not so much in season three, other than the brief mention in their first episode we'll get to, I'm sure. Yeah, I love Jerry Horn. So most of the scenes I'm going to say that I love, but the great thing about that one is that it ends with that line in the bunk beds. It's coming like full circle, like everything's ahead of them. Here's this like babysitter doing this dance on the hook rug or whatever with a great soundtrack, and you know, the shots of the flashlight on their faces. And you know, we cut to like they're in jail. Ben's been accused of Laura's murder. And Jerry has that great line, like, I think it's Lord, you know, what has become of us or whatever. It's a great nostalgic moment for two characters who don't seem very nostalgic. They're more like, I want to say self-centered, but like focused in on their pursuits of, you know, money and sex and power. So I did like that scene. It was unexpected. I like that they don't show who Luis Dombrowski is. It's a shadowed face. It's very like atmospheric, and it fits in the construct of the scene of them in jail. So no, I did like that scene, and I do think there's a kind of a sexual component of it, albeit in like who they are as opposed to in the actual scene.
Yeah, I would credit, it was Maya McBriar. She wrote about in Blue Rose a few years ago about that full circle dynamic, is that she was the person that would like kind of prompt them to have this like outlook of how they look at women. But then like once they reach that point when Ben is specifically in jail, the what has become of us, that like she kind of got them almost kind of into the lifestyle, but she also got them out of it at the same time. So I did like that part. The next thing I do have, though, is that I forget if it's in the Access Guide or the Secret History, but it shows that Jerry Horn was on the football team in 1968. Yeah, I think it was in the Secret History. And I think that I've heard a couple people, like they reference how most of the people in that were Bookhouse Boys. I have to say, though, is that Jerry Horn can't even like hide One-Eyed Jax from the Norwegians when he's a grown adult in this season one finale. So I have a very hard time thinking he's a Bookhouse Boy. But do you have any thoughts if he would be a Bookhouse Boy or if anything of that nature?
No,
my memory of I think the Secret or the Access Guide, I'm assuming that is, I probably haven't read that since it came out, or it's been a long time, that they discussed the football team and all these other different things. And I don't think Jerry Horn, I could be wrong about this, was part of that, but I think specifically he was mentioned in the secret history, like he was the punter or something like random or whatever. And because of all those other characters who were book husbands, no, I don't think. And I think with the final dossier, I know we'll get there or whatever, but I don't think Jerry, if that's what you're getting at, he might not even have any knowledge or even care about like the Bookhouse Boys. I don't think that those characters would actually think that Jerry would be someone that they could take in their confidence.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I just thought it was funny because like even on the Twin Peaks wiki, they tried to have the implication that he might have been a bunkhouse boy, but I just find it very hard to believe. We're gonna jump a little bit further, and it would actually be technically the missing pieces because it obviously wasn't the missing pieces itself, but because Johnny Horn's birthday is referenced in the Leland's scene when he's like, you know, leaving the Palmer home, and Laura also mentions it with her call to Dr. Jacoby in the missing pieces. I actually view this scene as like pretty much that it actually happened. For anyone who hasn't read the script, is that Johnny Horn, he wants to have his birthday in Ben Horn's office. Leland, he notices that there's a photo of Laura on Ben Horn's desk and not Audrey. So he points that out, and it becomes this huge point of contention for Sylvia and Ben. Johnny, you know, he's inadvertently not helping matters during this. But Jerry, his part in this is that he tries to be relatively lighthearted and try to defuse the situation. But he has this like really bizarre and cryptic interaction with Leland about the French, because he's asking Leland, like, what do you think that people, the French, get wild about? And he's going through these different guesses. And then when Leland guesses sex, Jerry says warmer. And then Leland says trees. And then they have this conversation that Sylvia scoffs at, but Leland, he justifies to Sylvia that Sarah's cousin is French and quote unquote, she can't stop talking about the trees around here. I think there's something that's just kind of crazy going on with not just the scene itself, but like what it means about like the trees and like, you know, that surround Twin Peaks. I know that there's a lot of ways to pull the thread on this, but do you have any thoughts about this scene about Johnny Horn's birthday?
Well, first of all, I wish that it had been filmed because not that it was integral to Fire Walk With Me as we know it, but obviously from the missing pieces, we have all these other scenes that were cut that are just great to see. And, you know, people make whatever fan edits or whatever, but it's still a great that they shot those specific scenes that weren't specific to the main storyline and more tangential. But that scene is interesting, especially the what you're talking about with Leland and Jerry, because the way that I read that scene was that, and I could be wrong, was that Jerry and Leland had kind of discussed this in advance. Like Leland was playing off Jerry as to like kind of sell Ben on the idea that they could play the French off the Norwegians or whatever. And that in itself is interesting. Not that that was in the script, but just thinking, okay, Jerry and Leland together without Ben discussing this little kind of like routine that they were going to do. And like, you know, kind of just like scripting it in advance, which just seems very odd, but I would love to have seen that. But obviously not the scene in general. We didn't even get to see that. For me, the most interesting part of that is what the comedic, I mean, you never know how Lynch is going to shoot it, but like Johnny Horn is going up to everyone, like right up to their face and saying, I think, happy birthday, Johnny. And they're saying, happy birthday, Johnny. And I would have loved to have seen how each actor reacted to that. It seems like the actual routine or the French with Sarah and her sister. That's all I think trying to just tie in the, I don't say the loose end, but connect Jerry returning from Paris and like his introductory scene. So, because there's not really, I mean, you could see like, you know, even if that scene was great and whatnot, and the context of things, you can see an editor going like, well, we're cutting this. This does not move the story forward because Laura's not in it. She comes in after the fact. But the tree component, I didn't really read that much into it when I came back to it, but you make a good point with that. I mean, I don't know what to like, you know, go into like, you know, the trees. Laura says the trees earlier with Harold Smith. I think the most important aspect of this scene is the picture, the photograph, which is another thing that they're maybe trying to connect later on in season two, where Audrey, or I think she sees it in season one, that, you know, it's also prominent in season two as we get closer to the reveal that Leland actually, I don't say confronts Ben, right? Doesn't he like kind of make, I don't know what does he say? Doesn't he like ask Ben specifically, well, why do you have a picture of Laura and not your daughter?
Yeah, the weird part is that I wish that there was something in the missing pieces. I know it wasn't filmed for obvious reasons, mainly with Richard Beamer and Sherilyn Fenn not being in it. But it says in the script that Leland is oddly confrontational when he asks, why don't you have a picture of Audrey? And it's really just to place emphasis on Laura. I mean, I'm asking a lot, but putting aside all the terrible things about Leland, it would be weird to see your boss having a picture of your daughter on his desk. And so that's one of the things that, like, of course, Sylvia gravitates to. Jerry just wants to divert attention for a variety of reasons, because, you know, for all the faults and foibles put lightly about Ben, he does care for his brother. So that's why he goes into the whole thing with Leland. But there's just something about, like, the equating sex with trees that I thought was just kind of like a strange way to go about it. Because when I look at the trees in Twin Peaks, I look as that, like, the wind with it. There's just something like an undercurrent of something insidious in the original series. When you get to the return, they're like very unwieldy and all over the place. So I just thought there was just something about that connection that I can't quite articulate what it is, but there's something about it that adds to this more insidious nature, because we don't get too many shots of the trees in Firewalk with Me, but when we do, we get like Dark Moods Woods, and it shows that there's something foreboding going on. And I just kind of wonder if how the scene, even if it's not in the movie, how it would add to that aspect.
Well, another thing that just
with you talking about this, like, we obviously we don't know the scene, you know, it was never shot, but with the sex and the trees, I immediately think of The Secret Diary and the scenes or the passages, because I think I haven't read this one in a while, but I recall there being a number of passages of Laura's entries of like her in the woods and Bob in the woods and talking about whether leading her to the woods or running off into the woods. And there's this kind of connotation of the darkness and the evil and the sex in the woods. And I think that there was a scene with like Donna and Laura maybe going skinny dipping very young in the woods or whatever. So this connotation of with Laura, sex, and then maybe the photograph of Laura in that office, Leland seeing it triggers that Bob. I don't want to get into the, like, you know, when is Leland Bob and all this stuff here or whatever, but maybe that's why he decides to be oddly confrontational and why it leads to the trees and the sex comment. I mean, that's the only thing that I can really speculate on, possibly.
No, you make a good point, because in The Secret Diary, I described it, I think it was in my Secret Diary episode, as like almost like a ritualistic abuse that Laura was dealing with Bob. So I know that Dave Lynch, he didn't read The Secret Diary, but I think stuff like this, it just like retroactively fits into why there's this like weird insidious nature and how Jerry can kind of get that out of Leland. And, you know, of course, Jerry doesn't know anything about Leland, about killing Laura, you know, or any of the more insidious stuff that we see in the original series. But I just thought that was like an interesting thing that Jerry was the one to get that out of Leland to begin with.
No, it is.
It really is. And, you know, not to be tangential with Jerry, but just I want to make this quick aside, because I think the centerpiece of this scene is the photograph of Laura. Obviously, it's Fire Walk With Me. It's her story. But there's that scene of Ben in the first season. I think it's the one where the funeral happens. And I think it opens with Laura's corpse. And, you know, I think, like, you know, Cooper's there, Albert's there. And I think Albert's fighting with Doc Hayward about the release of the body. And Ben is like staring at Laura's face. So this photo, and I like, it's another reason why I wish the scene had been filmed, because it's like you read the preceding scene in the script of Leela, it's like Laura and Sarah at the breakfast at the, you know, their dining room table, like having breakfast, and Leland comes in and goes, hey, it's Johnny Horn's birthday. I mean, it literally is that on the page. It's like interior Palmer House, Laura and Sarah sitting down, Leland. It's so small. But, like, you know, then we have that scene in The Missing Pieces. I mean, there's not a lot to it, but what Lynch is able to bring with just the most mundane aspects of this, any scene, is why he's David Lynch. And what he could do with, what, five people in this scene, and Jerry kind of leading it, right? Isn't Jerry kind of the centerpiece of this scene? He's wanting to present Ben with another business opportunity to leverage the Norwegians and to potentially make more money.
Because this is the last time we can really talk about Jerry before Laura Palmer's murder, and with the amount of time we talk about, I guess we should take into account that his trip to Paris was really only 2 days at most. But but I guess when he comes back, I think the best way to talk about it is that we can't talk about Jerry Horn without David Patrick Kelly, because I think that he is like the best choice, and actually the only choice, to play Jerry Horn, because he has that very erratic and idiosyncratic nature that he brings to the character. That while it is primarily humorous, there's always that undercurrent that something dark is there. Before we talk about Jerry Horn, the original series, did you have anything you want to talk about with David Patrick Kelly and what he brought to the role?
That's a great question. Thank you
for bringing this up. Because, yes, I don't even know if I could have said his name. Like, I don't know. But he was memorable to me in Dreamscape. I saw this movie when I was like very, very young, and he plays kind of a villainous role, and he's so good at it. And then he had a, like kind of a more a villainous role in 48 Hours, not that memorable, but he was also in a movie called Commando with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where you saw a little bit of, I want to say, of the comedic side, but he had something. He has this one line that he says to like Schwarzenegger about his daughter, which is kind of like a pre-Jerry line. It's a little bit more darker or whatever. But so, yes, he was some. I hadn't seen The Warriors. I think a lot of people know him from that movie. I think I saw that after the fact. But it was those 80s movies. And I think that's it. And then when he appeared, like, I knew him. And as I kind of knew, I was maybe expecting something darker from the movies that I saw. And maybe that's the reason why I came to, like, really love his character. More so because of his performance and the actor, is because it wasn't as dark. You know, he was, I'm gonna say, he's not a buffoon, but he's like, he's the PR man of the Brothers Horn. He's the one that gets to go to France and Norway to regale these potential investors. And I think David Batchelor-Kelly is a theater actor primarily, not primarily, but, you know, starting out. And I think he did a lot of avant-garde pieces. He's a very like serious person, but he's a great actor. And I think he was a great choice. And it's also interesting because, correct me if I'm wrong, Colin, maybe you have more insight into this, is that maybe Lynch cast him from Wild at Heart that he was shooting concurrently, which was, I think the casting director, Joanna Reid, is all of David Lynch's movie. I think she was the casting director of Dreamscape. So maybe that's why, but like how, like, where did David Lynch see Jerry Horn and David Patrick Kelly in Wild at Heart? Because A, he's not in that many scenes, and, you know, he doesn't really have a lot to do in the movie.
I forget, it might have been in Dennis Lim's The Man from Another Place, or maybe even Room to Dream, but I could have sworn I heard that David Patrick Kelly, when he was actually offered Twin Peaks, but then he was a little weary because, you know, TV, you could find work, but it wasn't really, it certainly wasn't what it is now. It was sort of like considered more of like low grade. It was sort of like very mass produced. I heard that it was either Nick Cage and or Laura Dern that said you should go for it. You know, I'm sure that he had people that were, he was talking to, but yeah, it took some talking from someone in Wild at Heart to say like, yes, you should absolutely do this. And honestly, I think it was like the right thing because, you know, you mentioned Dreamscape, but I'm thinking of The Warriors because he's the villain in that movie, but he's not a traditional villain by any means. He's like this scrawny guy. He's very Weasley, but he also has that great times of improv. Like, you know, it's the, when he's clanking the bottles and saying Warriors come out to play, that was completely on him. Like no one asked him to do that. He just did it. And the director just loved it. And I think there's just that spontaneity that he has, you know, in The Warriors and as Jerry Horn that I think fits perfectly. And to come back to the original series, that when he comes in, I think it says a lot about his character because he's very funny. He seems very welcoming. He has this energy, but he's also kind of belligerent to the people about his luggage and where to place it. He brings in the Breen baguette sandwiches, and it's just like this very over-the-top scene of what was a very dull dinner to begin with. And he has this, you know, has this fun energy with Ben. And then Ben says like, oh, Leland's daughter's been murdered. And it changes tone. He's like, oh, now I'm depressed. And then Ben, to kind of come back around, he's like, well, you know, let's take a trip to One-Eyed Jack's to turn that around. So, like, just in this scene, we have all these, like, crazy different ranges of emotions. And we haven't gotten into the insidious parts of the Horn brothers yet. In fact, this is where we start to find out just how insidious they are.
Yeah, no, I could probably talk an hour just on this scene. And I think it, outside of, now maybe just first season, outside of Cooper and Laura, their introduction. I mean, Laura's introduction, you know, the wrapped in plastic, or the reveal is so iconic. And then Cooper's is probably the best character introduction in television history, at least in my opinion. But for Twin Peaks' sake, for me, I think Jerry Horn's introduction is, I mean, the best is, I mean, it's purely subjective, obviously, but it's my favorite. I love Jerry Horn. He's not my favorite character. He's one of my favorites. But it's just so perfect because you've got that static shot, you know, of this, you know, solemn dinner with his family. Cloud, you see the directed by David Lynch. I mean, you almost kind of know this to begin. This is going to be a David Lynch directed episode, just the way that the static shot and how it's framed and whatnot. And then Jerry comes in and you make a great point of like, I don't really kind of think about it, like how he's treating the staff, but him, like, you know, being privileged growing up in a wealthy environment and in the Great Northern Hotel, he probably has not animosity, but he probably doesn't really just, you know, consider the people that work there. I mean, he's certainly not rude, or he's just kind of like they're non-existent. The most important thing is the moment, and the moment is the baguette. That's all he gets. Get that baguette going. And I mean, and then it goes from there. I mean, like I said, we can break it up. Let's talk about that intro, which you described. But for me, when he goes to Audrey, Uncle Jerry, and then he goes to kiss Sylvia, and she turns away and he makes this kind of look like, oh, he's like rebuffed over, but you know, he doesn't care. He's on to the next thing or whatever. He takes over the room. He's the uncle, he's the brother-in-law, he's the brother, you know, he's all these things, but you know, he's like, okay, all right, I did my introductions with, I did like, okay, I'm back with the family. Now it's like, they're not there. Ben, all right, before like we talk about what I was doing, I got to, you know, bring out these baguettes. We got to, and it's like, it's just such a random, strange, peculiar, but yet real moment that it soars. And, you know, then it gets absurd with the tearing into the sandwiches. And I'm sure you're familiar with it. Wasn't it like Lynch had to tell Richard Beamer to go like even more extreme, like each time?
If I remember Richard Beamer, I think when he bit into it, he just bit it normally. When Lynch said, like, you know, do it more over the top. And then Richard Beamer's like, but this guy's in an Armani suit. Like, he's not going to go that crazy. I think that's why there's one bite and then there's like three or four bites in the next shot, because he just like had to get more over the top with the previous one. I mean, to be honest, I mean, no one can really say how Lynch's mind works, but the fact that he actually insisted upon that and it worked so well, and is also, as we're talking, is like a great introduction to Jerry and just like the energy that he brings, especially since the dinner is so static leading up to that point. Yeah, I think that this is just like a great introduction and just a great scene all around.
Yeah, it's just not only the energy
of the scene, but he brings Ben alive, just his presence. And then, you know, we talked about the nostalgia of the jail cell scene in Louise Dombrowski. I had completely forgotten, you know, when they're biting into the sandwiches, it reminded them of two girls. I want to say it's Jenny and Jenny. And I think that one might have a sexual connotation to it in their adolescent years or whatever. I don't know, but I think there might be something to that. It's certainly like leading up to where we're going with One Eye Jacks and the Reputations or whatever. But I want to talk about Jerry Horn and David Patrick Kelly, his intonation, his voice, for me, with the acting choice of how he naturally speaks. Watching these different movies, I think he varies his tone. His tone as Jerry somehow resonates with my brain and activates the laugh track, you know, inside of me. The way that he will utter a line, and there's so many of them. This whole like chat could just be me just, you know, riffing on Jerry Horn lines, because I've been doing it my whole life, basically, since I've watched this. The way he says, like, did you say Leland's daughter was murdered? And like, I'm depressed. I mean, it's like, okay, these are lines. They're on the page. Yes, Lynch is directing them. But like what he brings to those lines, for me, and I know he might not be like a super popular character with a lot of fans or people who watch the show, certainly because of the nature of the character and what they're doing. And I agree with a lot of that, but a lot of the charm, I think what makes him less toxic or, you know, not antagonistic, but he brings a charm. The actor brings a charm to the character that leaps from the page. And that's probably something they, you know, attributed to Lynch. He has such a great eye for casting. Like I said, I mean, he well may have known him from previous works before Wild at Heart, because he does have a line in Wild at Heart where, like, the Harry Dean Stanton scene where he's talking about a gun, and he says it's a Marine issue. He does it kind of in a Jerry Horn voice. Maybe something clicked. Lynch is like a master for these kind of like random serendipitous moments or whatever, these random moments turning into these iconic, you know, moments. But yeah, I just wanted to mention, yeah, the energy that he brings to the scene, but to bringing Ben alive, and also the genius of David Patrick Kelly and his intonations. It tickles me. Just throughout, I just love it. Do you feel the same way, or?
Yeah, no, that's the thing, is that when David Patrick Kelly is able to have that like fun energy, he's like the best part of that scene. And I think there's also just like the way that when Lynch directs him, especially how he can shift from like that funny part to something more, a darker underbelly. And I think that's a pretty good lead in for, you know, with One-Eyed Jacks, because they go there, they go to the Canadian border by boat, they go in, clearly not their first time either one have done this. And also, this is when the new girl shows up and they have a heads and tails. And of course, Jerry, he's not really happy about it. But during this time, he goes up to the bartender. I forgot which drink it was. So she says what's going to be in the drink. She's like, oh yeah, next stop, rocket science. I'm like, man, this guy, he's kind of an asshole, but he's also at least funny about it. Like, even if he's not trying to be funny, at least certainly David Patrick Kelly's performance shows that.
Right. And I think that's
the genius of the casting is like in another, not to say another actor couldn't do it, but just the way that he says next stop rocket science. I mean, that's such a derogatory comment, but it makes me laugh. I don't take it seriously because it's coming from him, but just got to go back leading into the scene. Let's jump in the boat. Like you said, something that they've done a million times. Like we had those Vikings by the horns. I mean, he knocks out five or six little phrases for me in that first scene that still linger. I don't know if they do in other Twin Peaks fans, but yeah, once they get there, it's a double scotch on the rocks, I think. He goes like, I'll have a double scotch on the rocks and my brother. And she's just trying to get it right. But it's interesting that the bartender, there's a little flirtation going on there. I'm assuming that obviously they've been there before. Maybe she's been the bartender that they know, that maybe that's another reason why he can get away with that line, is because it's not the first time that they've had a dialogue. They've encountered each other. So that's another component. But yeah, I love how Ben goes into this flowery Shakespearean quote. I don't know what it is. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day or whatever? And with Blackie, and Jerry's like, da-da-da-da. He goes right up, where's the new girl? You know, he's just like, it's all about, for him, it's like all work and no play make Ben and Jerry dull boys. And they're there to like not lose their shirt in the casino. They're there to take off their shirt, specifically with the new girl, which also sets up, it's another thing. It's like, okay, so we're learning about the dynamic of the Brothers Horn, who really dominate this town, say politically, economically, or whatever, learning about their individual quirks and whatnot, but we're also like moving the plot forward too in little subtle ways, freshly scented from the perfume counter. We're like, well, that's like what, an aside or whatever, but no, that actually means something. We find out a couple episodes later. So, you know, it's also like not only like a great scene, entertaining or whatever, but it's advancing the plot forward. You don't know it. That's great writing, but I like the dynamic. It's like, you know, Ben's the tall one. Jerry's the short one. He's kind of the clown looking. Ben's more kind of sophisticated, like in his Armani suit or whatever. Of course, Ben's going to win the coin toss or whatever. But I love Jerry's reaction. But Blackie's going to take care of him. Of course, they own the joint. So, I mean, when you're watching this scene, Colin, for the first time, are you like, for me, it was intoxicating. Are you like, okay, I'm seeing a different side of Twin Peaks? Or you're just kind of going with the flow, wondering where it's going? Or the Brothers Horn like making an impression on you like it was making for me?
As for the one-eyed Jack scene, because I'm surprised, I don't think too many people bring this up, but up until before One-Eyed Jack's, you can kind of tell that Ben Horn's a sleazy businessman, that Jerry's kind of like, he's Jerry. But it's not until you get to One-Eyed Jack's and that there's something more insidious going on. Because, you know, by this point, especially certainly at first watch, you don't know who killed Laura Palmer. And I just remember, like, I don't know what it was that prompted me to think this, but when I saw the new girl for the first time, it just made me think of Laura in a very strange way. And I remember that was something that was kind of like over my head above all else when I was looking at the Horn Brothers and what One-Eyed Jack's was. And like, how much do we really know about these guys? And, you know, I love David Patrick Kelly in this role. And I didn't think for a moment that he killed Laura, but I just thought of like, how would he be tangentially associated? And so a lot of the goofy, the funny parts of them, it was starting to recede away into something more insidious. And I think that with, you know, when we talk about the Lynch directed episodes with Jerry, that's going to be something that still hovers around, not so much about Laura, but just about like what they bring to Twin Peaks, the town at large.
Right. That's a great point. You bring it up, because when I rewatched that scene recently, I had not remembered that the new girl, for me, evoked like the look of Laura Palmer. She looked very much like Laura. And then watching the scene when Ben is coming up to her, she looks like a little scared and a little nervous. And I can see like Lynch, I don't know if Frost was on set, I'm sure that he was maybe, but that was a direction, because they wanted to convey that subtly, you know, that she's a new girl, obviously meeting the owner for the first time, but casting someone who kind of like looks a little bit like Laura Palmer was not a mistake. And that's something that goes over my head, like, you know, seeing this at such a young age or whatever, like you make very salient points. And I think probably most people were thinking that, but like for a freak like me, I'm just like, thinking about, like, you know, the just kind of the more kind of buffoonery and the funny lines or whatever. And it took more of an adult mind to kind of like read into it or look into, but it's all there on the surface. And that's a testament to Lynch and Frost creating so these different levels that it could, you can have this not wildly comedic scene, but it's very funny to me. And then go to a darker, insidious, potentially insidious place, like, you know, that. And that's Twin Peaks. I mean, that's great. So that's a great point that you bring up.
For the rest of the first season, we get more of that like goofier part of Jerry. And we can like kind of lean into the more funny parts, because you're mentioning about the whole like low-key flirtatious relationship he had with the bartender. I haven't thought of that before, but I think with Jerry, I don't think he has like that much in the realm of subtlety, because he's very conversational with the Norwegians. And that's when he meets Heba. And he's just like in love with her. I think that's when he has like the giant leg, and he's just talking about how like, I don't know if he brings up marriage, but he clearly, this woman's on his mind for more often than not throughout like this time in Twin Peaks. He's really fun with the Norwegians. He's probably the reason why they're partying in the late hours when Cooper is angry about it, and he's showing off to Diane. But also, I mentioned earlier is that it's around this time, right before the Norwegians are about to sign the deal, that he slips out One-Eyed Jacks. And I love this little moment with Richard Beamer and David Patrick Kelly, because there's something about like with the ice cream where there's just kind of this goofiness of like them celebrating. And there's just about the way Richard Beamer tucks it away from Jerry right beforehand. And Jerry kind of says, whoops. And clearly Ben Horn is not happy that, one, this deal is not going to close, but they know about One-Eyed Jack, something he doesn't want to publicly advertise. And then also, it's not even going to the fact that this leads to more conflict for them as we go into the season one finale, into the season two premiere.
Yeah, no, that Jerry
lets, I mean, he likes, I take full responsibility. He, of course, Jerry, that's what Jerry does. Jerry entertains. Of course, they're going to be up till dawn partying. He's got the big like goblet or whatever full of, I mean, and needs more pecan. You know, he's in his element there. He is regaling the Icelanders. And Ben is like, once he realizes that Jerry has spilled the beans about Jax, his first lie is like, all right, let's get him in the van. Let's get this done. He wants to know, Ben is the closer. Jerry's the one who's going to arrange everyone, and Ben's going to go ahead and close the deal. And that's what the machinations of Ben throughout first season. He's, you know, he's playing Catherine. He's trying to play Josie. He's trying to get this deal done. He's dealing with his own grief of, you know, Laura Palmer. And I don't want to get too tangential on Ben Horn here or whatever, but, you know, his actions are directly related to Jerry. And he, that's probably some of his frustrations with Jerry, is because he wants to, you know, he's dealing with all these things and trying to close it, you know, whatnot. He's supposed to be the closer. But Jerry, I think being Jerry and knowing him his whole life, he lets Jerry have certain indulgences. Obviously, he knows who Jerry is. And if you read the final dossier, it kind of gives a backstory of Jerry, the kind of just extolling more of these things here or whatever. But no, that those scenes, like, and you mentioned the first thing is like when Jerry is directed by David Lynch, just like another, and I don't want to make this, oh, this David Lynch is the best director of the Twin Peaks, all this stuff, because there's so many great things that not directed by David Lynch, but there's certain characters, and certain for me, that shine more when Lynch is directing than with other people. But in the first season, I don't think so. I think Jerry is consistent. That's, for me, it's more of the inconsistencies with the character. I guess we'll get into that. But like when he has the leg of lamb and he's like, well, you know, this rotisserie heaven, you sprinkle some like whatever, garlic, mint, or crush some mint. That's consistent from what we saw. And like his character in the first scene with, is it Heba, like, however you pronounce that. That's of course, Jerry's a ladies' man. Obviously, you know, I think he's showing it right from the start that, and I think it's confirmed in the final dossier that he never was married. You know, he just, you know, he goes from like a woman to, and it's consistent. So like those scenes, like after the introduction, it's more like it's moving the plot forward. And it's interesting because the Ghostwood plot, which this is all tied to, like Ben and Jerry trying to close this Ghostwood deal, that's like the central B plot of the first season. There's Who Killed Laura Palmer and the whole investigation. And there's Ghostwood. And then Ghostwood actually lasts longer than the Who Killed Laura Palmer, right? Because it continues until, like, you know, Ben has to sign it over back to Catherine. And then it's the stop Ghostwood. So I was thinking about that. It's like, and I'm still like, don't understand all of Ghostwood. I don't have a great business head, but for all the, you know, vernacular and whatnot, but I did find that interesting. So those scenes are like necessary, like plot wise, but for me, they're more interesting with the character tidbits.
And actually you said it in the middle of it. And I realized I've been saying the wrong thing this whole time during the first season. You're right that they're Icelanders. I'm pretty sure I've been saying Norwegians up until this point. So everyone listening, just pretend I said Icelanders and not Norwegians. And I think that'll be a good cap off for season one.
Real quick, Colin, I'm sorry.
We're the interject with I know your pain with that, with the podcasts. I mean, there's like, you know, editing. I wish there's so many things I could take back or whatever. It's like, I want it to be perfect. But you know what? People, they know, they appreciate, they understand. No one's perfect. And you know what? Frankly, I didn't even like connect it. And I probably said 25 different things incorrectly. So don't sweat small stuff, Colin. You do great.
That's fair enough. No, I think I would just like, when you said Icelanders, I realized that like, oh, the Norwegians are leaving is like one of the most like vocal lines in the pilot. Like, how could I overlook that? Anyways, with all that out of the way, with season two, we actually got two consecutive episodes with Lynch directing. And I think that we have a couple of like, I would say the more underrated scenes of the original series with Jerry are in this because, you know, around this time, it's at One-Eyed Jack's. Ben Horn is unknowingly like, you know, trying to get with Audrey. And luckily, it's actually Jerry that actually stops him. It's an emergency. But, you know, around this time, that's when he's with Blackie and he's waiting for Ben. And it's obviously he's not physically violent, but it seems like the way he's talking and he's getting more like adversarial. It just like, you know, it becomes like Blackie's not a good person. So, but like there's just a way that he's talking to her. And then the way he grabs the lamp, because of course Lynch loves his lamps, and he's shining on her. He's like, oh, you used to be so pretty. And it's just like, I think that's a scene that I realized that like, oh, there's something really creepy about Jerry. We don't see it that often. Like even the kind of stuff, like the duality of him in season one, it's really on full display in this scene. In terms of lighting, in terms of performance, this is one of the more underrated moments. But what do you think of this scene and Jerry's characterization at this point?
I completely agree. It's
not my favorite scene. I mean, most of the Jerry scenes are like great. I think it's the most interesting Jerry Horn scene because, I mean, he's had other scenes without Ben. But first of all, the context of the scene, like, you know, this is the very beginning of the second season. And I think it's like the first time we cut away from Cooper in his room being shot and seeing the giant and whatnot. And Jerry has a menace to him in this scene that is, you know, has been unseen that you wouldn't think, you know, I'm gonna say possible because he's just been so kind of like fun and loving and kind of like, I don't say stupid because he's not stupid. He's very intelligent, but he just doesn't seem to go dark or have those dark qualities that so many characters in Twin Peaks had. That's why I find the scene so fascinating. And then also his leather coat, the way that Lynch amplifies when he's moving, the sound of his leather coat, and that just adds to the menace. But yeah, and just and what he's doing, Black, you said it interesting. Blackie's not like a nice or a good character. I mean, she's a madam at a brothel and she's, you know, manipulating her employees and she's complicit with the horns. But you get a sense in this scene that the horns had something to do with maybe her addiction, which might have led to, you know, God knows what. And Jerry is kind of, you know, kind of, I'd say blasé about it, but he's upfront about it, letting her know kind of who's in control, you know, like, because I think he says some line and I don't really, it might be to like, they get a sense of something is wrong with all the other things that are going down, but he's upset about something that's not related to Blackie and he wants to know where Ben's pacing. So it starts off with this kind of like, it's off. The scene is off. The preceding scene with Cooper, I mean, like a lot of people have a problem with that pacing. Lynch is deliberately, I think, you know, subverting expectations here, not only with like, with what audience wants to know, but now with a character of Jerry, who's been so kind of like, you know, fun and love, not loving, but kind of a fun character. Now he's, you know, got this dark quality to him. So we're in simpatico here. I think it's his most important scene. It makes his character more interesting. Because now you can context, you can see he's got this side to him. And you're right. He's the one that interrupts Ben. I mean, another 10 seconds or whatever that, you know, he probably realizes that he's been, you know, trying to have sex with his daughter. and boom, you know? So yes, no, that's, it really is. And the way that he says, like, you know, this is kind of a Lynch Frost scene. It's like, we have an SNAG. You don't say we have a snag. You say we have an SNAG, something, you know, kind of cool. You know, I always liked that, you know, Brother Ben, we got an SNAG. Ben knows immediately, hey, that's more important than sex with the new girl. So I do. And this is like, you know, you said a back-to-back Lynch directed episodes. For me, this is the peak Jerry Horn and peak kind of Brothers Horn, these two episodes. And I'm sure we'll talk about a couple other scenes, but I'm with you on that scene with Jerry and Blackie being a really interesting scene.
Another scene I think is very underrated and great from all actors across the board. It's around when, I believe it's Ben and Jerry, they're debating on like which ledger to burn because each one has its pros and cons. And of course, this is where Ben comes out with the marshmallows. But it's actually the next part I'm thinking of is the scene with Ben, Jerry, and Hank, because I love the way that it's lit because it's like very dim. Each actor has their own body language. Like, just from the scene alone, you know everything you need to know about these characters and their dynamics, because Jerry, he thinks he's like, you know, he's got the money so he can push Hank around. And Hank, he's the strong man. I know fans will probably say otherwise. I think Hank is pretty smart, but he relies too much on his muscle. And while he can kind of put Jerry in his place, Ben is the one that's smart enough to just lay low, let them think what they think, and then he's going to play the long game. There's just something about the performance from all three of these actors and the lighting that I think Lynch like really brought something special out of. But what do you think of this scene?
Yeah, it's actually, it's
one of my favorite scenes. It's like, you know, it's that where, you know, Jerry says chopping wood inside, which was something obviously that we, Murphy and I love tremendously to name the podcast after. But I think that scene proceeds with Ben and Jerry, this long tracking shot from like the elevator, the Great Northern, down some hallways where Jerry's talking about some food dish. So they're just, and Ben's so like immersed into what Jerry said. So like, oh yes, because they love their foodies and whatnot. And the end of the scene, and they're coming up to the camera. I think Ben goes, Jerry, have you seen Audrey today? And it's like, oh no, I haven't. It's kind of, oh, they kind of after like an afterthought, then they go right into the office and it's like, okay, and you're right. Immediately there, it's really probably only lit by the fire, which is behind them and some other lights or whatever, but it sets that tone. And Hank doesn't move. He stands straight in the middle and Ben and Jerry kind of circle him like sharks, but maybe it's the opposite. Like you say, I mean, I think with a lot of characters, like I said, are handled better when Lynch and Frost are, you know, in kind of fully immersed and in charge. And this is a very strong Hank scene. It's a very interesting scene because I think the Brothers Horn are playing Hank and Hank is playing them and everyone knows it. They get satisfactory results from it and they just let it go without saying what's really on their mind. And what happens is that Hank actually wins, you know, which is, you know, kind of ironic or whatever. But I love the Jerry thing too, of like, Jerry's got the short man's disease. You know, he's like, I think Ben says, you know, you leave the thinking, the creative thinking to the Brothers Horn and, you know, you're a bicep and it flex when we say it or something. And I think Jerry touches his bicep and Hank flinches or whatever. And Jerry's like, that really makes me mad. Like, you see Jerry's ready to throw down. He's got little man's disease. Yeah. And he'd get thumped, but he doesn't care. He's got money, he's privileged, but he's ready to go. And that's also a little difference from season one, Jerry. It's like, you've got these, like, you know, like I said, these two episodes, this is classic. This is peak, you know, Ben and Jerry. Jerry specifically, Ben's got some other great moments, but this is the highlight of Jerry. We talk more about the ledger. I think that's the next episode with the smoked cheese pig, which is like, I mean, come on. I mean, like I said, I could talk an hour on that scene. I mean, it's plot heavy, right? So you get two ledgers, it's Ghostwood, it's the result of the fire and all the stuff they were talking about in the office with Hank. But Jerry's like got the smoked cheese pig and it ends with, you know, where are those hickory sticks? We're not going to burn the ledgers. We're going to burn some marshmallows. I mean, how could you not love these guys?
I'm glad you brought up the scene, the bicep scene, because that's the specific moment when David pokes Chris Mulkey and he just has this like back off of me sort of demeanor. That's a scene that solidified that, like, this is what I think is one of the most underrated scenes from the original series. And I'm surprised it's not brought up more because I think, like I said, it just says everything you need to know about those characters and what they think about each other, how they think independently. But I think that we don't get too much of Jerry after these events, but he does definitely show up when he is Ben's lawyer. And I'm pretty sure it's either Cooper or Truman, but he is called out instantly for being outlawed in like four states and that he was at the bottom of his graduating class. I get the whole Ben, you know, it's his brother, but he really could have picked a better lawyer. Like, literally, the only thing that Jerry does right during this time is that he restrains Ben from like hitting Truman because actually, it's because Jerry's actions. He says, like, you've had Ben for 24 hours, either incriminate him or let him go. And of course, Harry just says, you are under arrest for the murder of Laura Palmer, which instantly backfires. So I really love this dynamic with the two of them. I think there's just something that's really funny about, once again, David Patrick Kelly just playing that like very short-sighted lawyer. He's out of his depth, actually kind of making a bad situation worse for Ben. And this is like not even the worst that gets for Ben in any way, shape, or form, even.
Yeah, Colin, I'm sorry, because I love Jerry so much. I'd be remiss if I didn't go back just a little bit. I'm sorry. I will get to the scene because I've got some points on that jail scene. But you mentioned with Hank and the scene we were just talking about with Hank and Ben and Jerry in the office, it really is like a very strong scene. It really is. And I think when you were discussing it kind of made me think like, well, why is it not like, okay, this is like an iconic scene or whatever, but I think the characters, I don't think these three characters, Ben, Jerry, and Hank, are super, super likable. Obviously, they have their flaws, their warts. I just don't think they're the more kind of popular characters in, you know, when people are, you know, fans of Twin Peaks watching the show or whatever, or maybe resonate. I think they do on a more of a niche level. So I think there's that. And then I just want to talk about real briefly, there's, okay, probably my favorite scene. I think it's maybe my favorite line reading. It's like, and I don't want this to just be like, oh, Tom talks about like just the way that, you know, David Patrick Kelly talks, you know, speaks in Jerry Horn, speaks as Jerry Horn. But when Leland comes in and they're trying to like, you know, trying to keep the Icelanders away from like, they don't want them to know about the fire. And Leland comes in and they're like, oh, Mr. Palmer told you about the fire. And Jerry's trying to interact. He's speaking like Icelandic, like Kunda blesser, and Jerry, he's like making a, you know, just a mess of it, and like Leland is making a mess of it, and he leaves finally, and Ben says, "Jerry, please kill Leland." They're looking like kind of like side profile, you know, the way that Lynch has it framed. They're not looking in the camera, looking just off, and they're right next to each other. It's just a great, you know, it's a great frame, and Jerry says, "Is this real or some strange and twisted dream?" It's just, and then it ends, it goes to commercial. Like if you're watching it originally, you go to commercial there. And, you know, now it's going to go to the next scene. Well, maybe it'll go to commercial and streaming or whatever. But that scene, not only like just the inflection of Jerry, like just the dynamic with their lawyer mucking things up for them, but like, is this real or some strange and twisted dream? Not that this buzzword dream, but it, you know, plays into these themes that are going to be more prominent as we go forward. And especially with Jerry in season three. So like I said, I had to mention those. I know with Twin Peaks fans, different scenes mean different things to different people or whatever.
I'm stunned I didn't write down notes about that last line before the commercial break because I remember it must have been my first or second rewatch, but it was just like the look on Ben and Jerry's faces because Leland is coming in and may or may not be deliberately sabotaging stuff on their end. But there's just something about like the slowness of when Jerry says something about how this is some twisted dream. With a return in retrospect, I was like, is he tapping into something? Is he aware of something? There's more I can say about the return once we get to it, but I think there's something about Jerry is that maybe I don't think he's necessarily as smart as you think he is, but I think there's something intuitive about Jerry that he occasionally taps into.
No, I think you're right. And I think
the only reason why I say the intelligence factor is because I reread the part of the final dossier where Frost wrote that he speaks four languages, and there's a couple other things that like maybe like because it's you're right when you watch the show. I mean, he's not like, you know, super intelligent, but he has to be reasonably intelligent for a number of things, including eventually passing the bar. But which I yeah go into now talking about that scene. It's like, that's not a Lynch directed episode with him coming in. I think it's more kind of more gimmicky to me of like, okay, Ben's in jail. All right, how do we deal with this creatively? All right, we'll get Jerry's his lawyer. We'll just do that. It seems more kind of gimmicky and to make him more kind of a buffoon than I think he is. Like he says, like with the blood test, your fingerprints might be on her blood, which is, I mean, come on. I mean, that's like ridiculous. No one's going to think you could like deduce like your fingerprints for blood. So they kind of amped that up, his kind of like buffoonery a little bit too much. It didn't feel like real to me. It felt more kind of like we could shoehorn Jerry into this scene. And there is some good things. Like another great moment is when they bring the one-armed man in there. And he's sniffing around like, and Jerry even says, have him stop, like, tell him to stop looking at me like a dog biscuit. But he goes like, Bob, who's Bob? I don't know, Bob. I mean, it's just the way, it's just hilarious to me. And then of course we had the hook rug, you know, the Louise Dombrowski thing or whatever, but I think it was more kind of creatively a way to bring Jerry back. We did get some more dynamic with their relationship, but it just didn't ring true to me. And I don't like it when characters, it's like kind of like a Seinfeld thing, like with, I don't want to get too tangential, but like in the later season, George Costanza is kind of like much dumber than he was in the preceding seasons. And it's like, it kind of always bothered me. It doesn't ruin the experience, but someone like, you know, and not just with Jerry, with other characters, but you know, it's not it's just more irksome. It's interesting that jail scene. It's like, it's kind of got it's a triptych, right? You got the introduction, him showing up, and then, or I think it's in the bunk bed, and then like he's trying to take charge, but we realize from Cooper, you know, reading up on his file, like he's incompetent as a lawyer. And then I think it ends with the one-armed man scene. So it's like kind of like really the last hurrah of Jerry Horn in the second season, even though we get his return later when Ben is coming out of his whatever delusion.
I'm actually kind of okay with Jerry being a bit of an incompetent lawyer. I think there's just something about, it's like what I was mentioned about him with his scene with Hank, where I think he thinks he's, because he's wealthy and powerful, that he kind of pushed it in ways where he's like very short-sighted about it. But I think that when it comes to the characterization of Jerry Horn kind of diminishing, it is actually during the Ben Horn Civil War arc, because, you know, of course, Ben, he's already having a midlife crisis as is, but Catherine Martell perpetuates it. And the thing is that, you know, I know I made it very clear, I don't care much. Actually, I just really don't like the Ben Horn Civil War arc. But I still think that even if it was well written, there's still some weak writing for Jerry Horn, because he has this very one-dimensional, oh, I'll take over the business. And Audrey, she has a way to circumvent that. And actually, David Patrick Kelly, he said he liked that dynamic of how Audrey could like knock him down a peg and put him in his place. I think that does fit in with Audrey, because she doesn't have the femme fatale part of her from season one has scaled back in season two. But I think this fits very much in character. It's just that with Jerry, it just seems very one-dimensional. And even though I was saying he's short-sighted as a lawyer, this just feels very surface level. I think that unfortunately, as we close out with Jerry in the original series, the character is just kind of like more diminished by this point for me, sadly.
I agree. I always think of
being comparable to Albert. You know, Albert was, it's integral from the procedural aspect, but like, you know, not, I mean, you could probably do without Albert, but because he was so popular, I mean, popular, maybe it's too strong a word, but I think he had a presence. He was so fun to write from the creative side. And I think he did make an impression that maybe there's a few more Albert scenes than probably should be necessary. And I think Jerry kind of fits that mold, because you know, it's starting losing its luster with him being the incompetent lawyer. And then now coming back, for me, him seeing his brother in that, you know, diminished state, in that disheveled, delusional, whatever state, depressed state that he's in, that he would like, you know, almost immediately think like, oh, okay, this is an opportunity for me and you, Audrey, to kind of take, and then she, you know, steps in, like you said. And I think that that's the only way that they could go, or that's what they chose, to put more importance on her character. It's like, oh, let's make her the new Ben Horn, basically, because she was in One Eye Jacks from like the end of the first season. So as maybe it's just like Jerry was just a prop for Audrey to get to that position, or to have that line, because I mean, she winds up kind of running things a little bit, or she's now in a new role. So yeah, I didn't like that. I did like the line of like with the pine weasel, like they're great roasted. I mean, that was kind of like a great send off for Jerry, but it's just a line. It's just like his arc, his character really kind of diminished, but I think it was because he was integral to like when Ben and Jerry were kind of like on top. And it's very interesting to think about, not that Lynch and Frost are, or Ben and Jerry are avatars for Lynch and Frost, but if you think about their dynamic, that here they are, Ben and Jerry are the most important people in the town, like economically, politically, or with power, just like Lynch and Frost are the creators of Twin Peaks. And really, like, their arc of when things started to kind of maybe slow down a little bit, like, you know, with the execution and it not being as consistent, is also consistent with those characters. Like, I think of, like, you were saying you're not a fan of the Civil War scenes. Like, I'm not either. I mean, I can find some pleasure in some moments or whatever. Not pleasure. I can find some moments of, like, okay, that works or whatever. But as a storyline, I just don't think it works, and it goes on much too long. But just, like, thinking about, like, that arc of, like, Ben and Jerry, like, that was around when Lynch and Frost, you know, kind of, I would say, checked out. There's all kinds of debates with that, but I think it was obvious that both of them weren't, you know, at least Frost, who was always, like, show running, wasn't on on the ball, but he wasn't, like, you know, as present. He wasn't putting in the hours that he did. And that's when the brothers Horn are kind of at their most vulnerable state. And then they kind of come back again at the end. Here we were talking about the Pine Weasel with this new Ghostwood campaign, just like Lynch and Frost doing, like, the coup thing. I think it was Citizens Opposed of Offing Peaks or whatever. This campaign originally to keep Twin Peaks on the air. So it's interesting to have that arc, something. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. It's just me being a Twin Peaks nerd going, like, oh, there's, like, a, you know, there's a parallel there.
I think that's actually a good point you make about the Lynch and Frost parallel, because I know Tony Kranz said in an interview with Twin Peaks Unwrapped that I think that him, Lynch, and Frost were all at a restaurant together. He had to put their hands together. It's like, this show needs the two of you. Yeah, because it is around that time when Lynch, I think he was more focused on his exhibit in Japan. And I think Frost was kind of one foot in, one foot out with Storyville. But I do want to come back to one thing, because we're talking about how characters are written, like, late in season two. At least with Albert, we get a couple of, like, really great scenes with him. Because I think that Miguel Ferrer, he gets a lot of great stuff that he can kind of, like, really sink his teeth into. Like the part when Shelley and Bobby are leaving, and he says, get a haircut, punk, I think. But then we get that great scene where he hugs Harry and shows, like, how far that relationship has come for the two of them. But as for Jerry, I think the last scene is that he meets John Justice Wheeler and just sort of, like, a hi. And then he's just kind of written off afterwards. I mean, Miguel Ferrer certainly had, like, these great Albert moments, but yeah, Jerry, as far as the original series go, you know, David Patrick Kelly has a good energy, but he just didn't have really the material to work with as it progressed.
Right. And for Albert, for me,
it was mostly like the Josie being the shooter storyline. That's the one that seemed like, I want to say shoehorned, but it seemed like, cause he came back. I think that was the reason to bring him back, is like the fibers or whatever. And it's legitimate. It didn't have that potency. I think he's kind of like Coop. Like, he was more kind of like arrestor, and Coop was more sensitive with Josie. I don't want to get tangential, but the one thing before maybe we wrap up with Jerry with season two, but that Civil War arc, to bring Ben out, they have to, everyone gets in character, right? Like, as a Civil War character, even I think Audrey, I don't know if it's like kind of a Gone with the Wind thing. I mean, I don't know, but it seemed like that, her outfit. But knowing what we know of Jerry and Jacoby, because I think they do the Appomattox scene, the sign, the thing. So knowing what we know about them in season three, and they wouldn't have done this, or they didn't have the foresight or whatever, but like now you can kind of see like a missing piece from that scene is that maybe they like both ripped a bong hit before sitting down at that Appomattox scene. Because knowing, hey, we got to get into these, why do we have to play these Civil War characters? Well, let's have some fun with it. You know, let's get high. Because both of them obviously are doing that in season three. And apparently, according to the final dossier, I think that's, Jerry has always been at, like, you know, high, which I think is a retcon, but, you know, I digress.
Still a good segue in the final dossier, because I was saying that, like, you know, we were talking about the intelligence of Jerry. And one of the things I do have written down is that, you know, he did profit tremendously on marijuana legalization, and he would become friends with Jacoby around this point as well. I think that with Jerry, as much as I was ragging on him for the lawyer aspect, I feel like what we see with him in The Return, that if he has his mindset on something, he probably can and will get it done and make a good chunk of change off of it. And we actually did talk about it a little bit earlier. According to Tammy, he knows four languages and is business savvy on a global scale. I can get the global scale part, because like you're saying, he's the PR guy. He's like the friendly face of like the Horn brothers. But I would honestly challenge the veracity of Tammy's statement of him knowing four language, at least fluently. But did you ever anything in the final dossier with Tammy having bad information for Jerry in particular?
Probably, but isn't that the whole, like, isn't that the kind of the theme of the final dossier is kind of the fuzziness of things that even kind of gets there, like where she's like not remembering certain things, which plays into kind of the theme of the end of the return and whatnot. But yeah, we're just reading through. It's very short. I think it's only like a couple of pages. But yeah, I was reading through that. It was like, yeah, it's a kind of like, I'm saying retconning, but yeah, I wouldn't. I mean, he was doing that. I think it's because he was doing this kind of, he was speaking pidgin Icelandic or whatever, or like, you know, whatever, or Norwegian or whenever, French. So maybe that was Frost when he was like, you know, returning to write the final dossier. He's like, oh, well, can maybe Jerry, because he creates this whole backstory of Jerry of like, you know, I think like probably act like in real life, Richard Beamer is, I think he might be like 10 to 15, maybe 10 to 15 years older than David Patrick Kelly. But I think that the characters of Ben and Jerry are probably closer in age. Like the timeline doesn't work for if you read that. I think because Frost has Jerry in the final dossier, like at Woodstock, which is like 69. I mean, I don't care about that stuff, like the inconsistencies of certain things or whatever, but I think it's just Frost has like certain peculiarities. Like we were talking before the show about Jack Parsons and the secret history or whatever. But so he mentions the Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters. And I think Ken Kesey is the author of the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. So I think it's like just something that creatively Frost was like, okay, because of the return, or maybe this was a seed that he already had in his head when he was writing it with Lynch, that he was going to, you know, make Jerry Horn this kind of hippie character. He was always a hippie. It's just that he kind of like during the Reagan 80s, you know, it was all about like money and consumerism and They Live, you know, the movie, the John Carpenter movie is about, you know, capitalism and whatnot, that Jerry had this phase where money was more important than this kind of hippie mentality that kind of came full circle. So, you know, it's funny though. See, that's the thing, is that I think maybe it was Frost, you know, attribute the writing to Jerry and the first two seasons. Like when I was rereading the final dossier, it was funny to me, like the stuff that he had for Jerry, like creating like two cabins in the woods, like as speakers. And then like, you know, and one is like a subwoofer or something, and then rowing out to the lake and like playing Miles Davis's Bitches Brew, which is actually one of my favorite like albums. It's like a great, like another, like, okay, this is meant to be that I like Jerry Horn. So yeah, I think it's like something that's in kind of Frost's wheelhouse. And, you know, I would have loved to have been on a fly on the wall with a million things with him and Lynch, but like creating Jerry for the return. One thing I would like to know is like, if they had that in mind, either one of them had it in mind in advance, or it was something that came up organically. My guess is that Frost probably was like, okay, these foodies, these kind of like, you know, whatever, you know, these bastards from the 80s are now like, one of them's like now like into marijuana, you know, whatever, like legalizing marijuana and profiting from his certain strains and whatnot.
The one thing I would find believable, and I actually would have, I know that this couldn't have been really filmed in either the original series or the return, but where Jerry Horn, he wants to treat his marijuana addiction with marijuana. And this is probably the thing that would prompt him to make it legal. And also, we were mentioning about the turning two cabins into a speakers and a woodshed into a subwoofer with Neil Young. And this isn't even Tammy. It's Jacoby may or may not have confirmed that it led to a small avalanche. This seems like it's in character with some that Jerry would do. And of course, the final dossier, we have to take everything with a grain of salt. But I think that's one thing that's worth mentioning, and this is probably a good way to veer into the return, is that he does become friends with Jacoby during this time, and is clearly an active listener, as we see in the return, but is also a financial supporter of Dr. Amp. This is something that just seems like it fits very perfectly with Jerry, now that we're talking about the full circle of the hippie, very counterculture mindset that he would have had. But then the 80s, like 1989, he'd be in that heart of the business of it. But then he would just come back around to just doing this. And I think that this is also a good way to get into the return, because one of the first scenes we see is at the Great Northern. It's after Beverly Page comes in, Jerry comes in, and it feels like Ben and Jerry, they're very much similar and different at the same time, because with Ben, I got the sense that he always stayed on it as a relatively good enough guy after the whole Stop Ghostwood campaign. Like, you know, he's not carrying the carrot anymore, but he's, you know, he's a more realistic good. And then you have Jerry, who, like, the moment he sees Beverly, you know, he's of course talking to Ben about her, and Ben's like, she's married. So that hasn't stopped you before. I always took it as a callback to just the original series. I know that Twin, you know, The Return doesn't really do explicit callbacks, but I've heard a couple of people even say that Ben has had his, like, his affairs during that 25-year period. But where do you stand on that?
Oh, so you're saying that Ben is still
playing the field or still having affairs from the time after season two to The Return?
Yeah. For me, I think that it's like, you know, after Audrey called him out, like that was like the most shameful moment of his life. And then everything subsequently falling apart. Yeah, people had different thoughts on when Ben would stop having these affairs. I was just curious, based off what Jerry said, where you stood on it.
I think that he probably
did, probably not as prevalent. Obviously, you know, he's still married to Sylvia, right? But she lives in a separate house or has her own house, or maybe, I mean, I can't remember. Did they get divorced or were they still married?
I kind of took it as they were divorced because, again, the final dossier, take it with a grain of salt, but he just sleeps in the Great Northern. He doesn't even have his own house. He just, or maybe he does, but he just stays at his own room in the Great Northern. So I took it that even if they're not divorced, they basically act as if they're divorced. So obviously there's differences if you're in that situation, but, you know, to me, they might as well be divorced.
Yeah, I think he probably did have affairs because, like I said, probably not as many. Because Ben seems like stuck, which I think is kind of like a theme throughout The Return. Like we don't see any scenes of him outside of that office. And he's obviously, I think, stuck with, pun intended or whatever, be a better person. Obviously, I think that the business ventures of like everything is really been scaled down. He's probably only focused in on the hotel and let Jerry do more of the, you know, kind of more maybe the fancier, more whatever, wilder ideas and whatnot. And he's been successful. Jerry's been successful with the marijuana business, especially with it being Washington State and it being legalized there or whatever. But Jerry's not. I don't think Jerry's stuck. So I think that's interesting, that first seeing that dynamic is that Jerry's like, you know, calling Ben for who he is or who he knows he is. And Ben's like, he's still trying in his old age. And Jerry's like, no, I'm not going to be like stuck by, I am who I am. He's probably trying to do better himself. And there's a little bit of, you know, a friction there, but it's brotherly friction and it doesn't really go anywhere. But I think Ben doesn't have an affair with Beverly Page because maybe he's accepting his age. Maybe that has something to do with it. And I think maybe he knows a little about her situation. Maybe there's been one too many women in that position in the past that he has had sex with. And maybe he likes her. I mean, she's kind of a likable person. I think she likes him. And I think she likes him in a romantic way. And I think that maybe is enough for Ben at that moment, that he knows that she still finds me attractive, whether it's my stature or whatever. And that's enough for Ben, but he's still stuck, still trying. Jerry's a different beast, which I'm sure we'll get into, but yeah, for that, to answer your question. So yeah, I don't think Ben's perfect. I think he's still haunted by that, by the events of, you know, 1989, 1990, and especially with Audrey. And I'm glad that you brought that up because that was the moment that I think precipitated his breakdown. He didn't go full Civil War then, but like when she called him out and he knew, oh my God, that was you at One Eyed Jacks. That was really the end of Ben Horn, really, as we know it.
I agree. And you actually touched on something that I don't think I've been able to talk about on the show. And obviously, Jerry's going to be a huge contrast, but I think Ben Horn in The Return is sort of like, he sort of like fits with a theme of confinement of people who are stuck in their ways. And of course, Jerry is like the ultimate stark contrast. But I think this is a good way to segue into Jerry's overall arc throughout The Return. Because, you know, of course, when, you know, he can't find his car, he yells, I think I'm high. And I know that gets a big laugh. But the thing that I get a kick out of is, surprisingly, is Ben. He, you know, he hears Jerry just having a breakdown. He's like, what? And then Jerry's like, can you have a breakdown? Correct me if I'm wrong. It looks like it's the same shot reused. But a second time, Ben just says, what? I think it's like partially because the way that Richard Beamer performs it, it's sort of in this like, I can't believe this is happening, but I can absolutely believe this is happening. Before we get into Jerry's odyssey, because this is the last person he really interacts with, do you have any thoughts about Jerry with like everything that's going on at this point?
Oh yeah, no, I mean,
You're talking about, you use a better word than I do, like confinement with the stuck, but that, like, with the whole overall, the themes of Twin Peaks, for me, that why they resonate, being older, seeing the show, as a teenager and then seeing it as someone who's 142 years old, but like they resonate more. But I think Lynch and Frost, they played these themes of like life, not just confinement, but like, age, time, loss, all these different things are play huge, a huge role in season three. And I think that's why it'll continue to resonate for, years to come, because it's eternal. These themes are eternal. But it's I would say it's ironic. I guess maybe it is kind of like talking about Ben and Jerry, maybe Jerry being not stuck and Ben being stuck. And but Jerry gets stuck, at least for a time, in the woods. It's funny. I mean, I think it's meant to be funny. I don't think it's like, this is like, high up on like what Lynch and Frost are trying to, get across in season three. But I also don't think they're trying to shoehorn these two characters. I don't think anyone in season three was shoehorned. I mean, you could say maybe like the Mike Nelson, but that still works. It's like, okay, it's perfect. He's selling cars or whatever, and he's got a great line, a great moment with Steven. So I don't think Jerry is shoehorned. I think they had a very like they had a reason to bring him back and to have him in that setting. And for me, and I don't think I got this on like first, second, third. I mean, I really haven't watched The Return. I mean, really, since we stopped doing our show, because I watched it so many times, so it's seared in the memory, just like the original series. But I don't think we talked about this, because I don't think that's what's so brilliant about The Return, is that it's so dense. There's so much going on. It's impossible, A, to predict, and B, to just, okay, this is what's going on, or have an opinion. I mean, you have an opinion about it, but it's going to change. That's why it's such a work of genius, in my opinion, even with some flaws. But Jerry, thinking about it now, I think he gets stuck and he goes through what he goes through in the woods, because it's related, I'd say tangentially, it's related somewhat to Cooper's plight, because of what Cooper is in season three. Is if Fire Walk With Me is Laura's story, and the first two seasons is really, who killed Laura Palmer, and I know it recedes in season two, but really it's Laura Palmer, and especially the Lynch. That season three is Cooper. I mean, Laura plays a huge part. I mean, huge, even though she doesn't have the screen time. But it's Cooper. It's Cooper stuck in the lodge. He's been stuck, and then we've got the Dougie. It's really Cooper in Vegas. So for me, like thinking about it, okay, so in the original series, Cooper goes into the woods to save Annie, thwart, Earl, save the day, and gets stuck. And he's been stuck there. And he saw his doppelganger and didn't understand. He got scared. And what did he do? He ran away. He ran away from what he saw of himself, what he knew, and it didn't save him. And he's been stuck in this loop. So if you think about the Jerry thing, this isn't like a Cooper Jerry like theory, I think Lynch and Frost are doing this for a reason. They put a comedic spin on it. Jerry's in the woods. It kind of mirrors on like 42 levels lower than what the reality is of what Cooper is going through. And then what happens is that he's running away. Who's the first two people that he sees? He sees Mr. C, Cooper's doppelganger, and his great nephew, Grant. I don't know what it is. I think it's his great nephew, because that's Richard is Audrey's son, which so Audrey, his niece's son. So he comes face, not face to face, in a comedic way, through the binoculars, the wrong way, the distortion of like reality or whatever. And so that's who he sees. So like, and he continues to run away after that. I mean, he doesn't know he's so high, and he keeps going. And he takes a beeline south, I think, to Wyoming, because I think he winds up in Montana. I think that's where they are. And like, for me, he's going to, and he's purposely going to Odessa, but that's probably where he would wind up. Like, if continue, just because Odessa is Odessa. I'm not saying that has anything to do with Carrie Page or all that stuff, because Jerry's so minimal. He's not that important to that plot, that arc. But for me, that's kind of how I interpret it, that whole thing.
I think I come at it from a different perspective, but you actually unknowingly touched up on a lot of the stuff that I think of as well, because I think of how long his Odyssey goes on for, because Is it part? I think it's part 5, 6, or 7 where he can't find his car. It's definitely part 16 when he sees Mr. C and Richard Horne, presumably unknowingly. But I think of the time span that goes on the return, because I think it's only in the course of like 6 or 7 days for the most part, like all 18 parts. Yeah, the metric, I know I use this all the time, but the metric I use is in part 15 when Mr. C sees Philip Jeffries, like, was that you that called me 5 days ago? And I just think of like, man, I can't believe that thing in part two was 5 days ago. But we're talking at least, Jerry is in, he's in the woods for days. You know, he has the I'm not your foot scene, which, you know, I think is very classic Jerry Horn to me. But I guess the question I want to ask is that, do you think he feels those 4 days, or do you think time is different for him? Because this is actually where the Cooper part starts to kick in for me.
Yeah, no, I think time's different to him.
I don't think he's just high. I think he's high, but I think because now we're seeing the show, we're experiencing the show, and the timing of the woods, the scene of part two of Hawk going to Glastonbury Grove because something is supposed to happen, because I think Cooper is supposed to come out of the woods, but it doesn't because of the whole Mr. C thing, his plan, that starts distorting things. And I think that's what I think if Jerry was in the woods high watching Dr. Amp like 2 weeks prior to that, maybe he wouldn't have that experience. But because it's the show. So, yes, I think like and also there's these weird scenes in the woods, like with Stephen and Kirsten. And I think Miriam is the woman who sees Richard hit the child. He blows up her plate. I think she comes like crawling out of the woods because you know, she's all so the and just these shot the log lady's cabin is like always shot like it's always like dark. It's the light in the window, the shot, the beacon of light, but it's always foreboding and ominous. And like just the and even walking through Jackrabbit's palace in the daylight, it's foreboding. The sound design, the soundtrack, and I think about the missing pieces. This is something that there's a shot of the missing pieces in the convenience store scene. It like it ends and then there's this superimposition of Laura in the lodge with her face. And then it goes back to the people in the convenience store, the spirits. And then Lynch does this another superimposition of the spirits with the woods, with the cloudy, the misty and the fog. And they recede into the woods. And it's like that always felt super important to me. It's like, OK, so I know there's the evil in the woods that Truman talks about in the first season, but that. Being in the missing pieces and then getting the return a couple of years later, for me, when I was watching it in these scenes, the spirits, they're there, like they're omnipresent and they're screwing with Jerry Horn. And maybe it's he's not hearing I am your foot internally. I mean, he's hearing it, but maybe it's not like him just being super high. You know, maybe it's something else. So I do, it's a short answer, too late, long story too short. I do think time is being distorted. He's chiefly affected by that because, you know, how much time he's, I think the character spends the most time in the woods in season three.
The only time that we see it dark during that time is when he's watching Dr. Ramp, I think on an iPad or a laptop. And, you know, then the next day when he says, I think I'm high, I'm pretty sure it's broad daylight from then on out. And I think that when I was mentioning the thing about Cooper and his affiliation with this, because I still subscribe to the idea that when he tries to rescue Laura in part 17, that it just like this is something that really screws up time and that like almost realities overlap. And I remember it was in part 17. I don't know who it is, but clearly it's the authorities. They call Ben Horn. Again, this is another scene where Ben, he's shocked, but not really. He's like, what? In Wyoming? He's like, yeah. That's Jerry. But the thing is that, you know, the previous part, he was in, I mean, I guess we can't say he was in Twin, he was, is it Montana? I think that Mr. C and Richard were in Montana. And as silly as this sounds, I am telling you right now is that I remember after one of my rewatches, I looked at where Twin Peaks is located in Washington, where they were at Montana and Wyoming to see if there was any woods that overlapped like states. And to no one's surprise is that, no, that's not the case at all. But the way I look at it is that in one reality, Jerry would have just been like in Twin Peaks in the woods. But then another reality, because he's a free-spirited guy, he would be like, you know, in nature in Wyoming. And I think that there's something about the way Cooper screwed up timelines. I think that it mostly affects like Laura, Rhonda, Audrey, and a few handful of characters. But Jerry was actually someone who got caught up in it. And then the woods are this like amorphous thing, combined with the fact that the woods are very unwieldy in Twin Peaks. And I think that he's just like caught in the middle. And you made a great point, by the way, about when Hawk sees the curtains in like that first part or two. And I think that it was just like a perfect storm for Jerry to be caught in this, you know, because he was high. It was just something that exacerbated the situation.
Yeah, no, I agree with a lot of those points. And you know, the part 17 that you bring up, that's when a timeline I think actually skews, because I mean Lynch actually goes back to the pilot and shows Laura her body not washed up. But I think that, I mean, it's been like years since we were talking about this, but and since I've actually talked about this, but for me, things started to get fuzzy in the return in that second episode with Hawk at Glastonbury Grove, and actually continue to get fuzzy until like episode seven. Like that's the one where the diner patrons shift. And I know there's been like it's been confirmed by like Dwayne Dunham that it was like, no, it was the only shot we got or something like that. But it's Twin Peaks, you know, and it's like there it, for me, and then also these other things that I think, I mean, I could be wrong, but that's the episode where I think Hawk has the exposition scene to Truman, Frank Truman, of like Laura's diary and Annie and all this stuff. But I think like after that episode seven, like Laura like isn't mentioned. Her name isn't mentioned. It's mentioned like several times before that. And there's some other things that I can't remember. So for me, and then there's part eight. I mean, that's a different beast, but for me, it's like part two is when things get really like funkier than usual in the Twin Peaks woods, because I think they're always funky. Because now we know that there's a presumably White Lodge or whatever the Jackrabbit's palace portal is, which is, I'm assuming, in close proximity to Glastonbury Grove. So you have these two portals in the woods, it's light in the dark, it's going to be funky. But now, because we have Cooper, the 25 years thing, it's getting funkier. And then we got like a like him actually time traveling, however that works. So, I mean, yes, I think Jerry's like, I think when Lynch and Frost, I think they spent like a year talking about this before they actually started writing. That, like, when they got to Jerry and Ben, like, they're talking about that. It's like, okay, so Jerry's like, yeah, he's high on his own like product and he gets caught up in it. We got some funny moments that we can do here and could like maybe relate to some things thematically.
I'm glad you mentioned that shot, reverse shot of the double R at the end of part seven, because that's actually one of the things that reaffirms the idea that there's two realities that are overlapping. Because I guess to elaborate when I talk about like what Cooper screwed up is that I think that if there's one reality where Laura is murdered and then another where she just goes missing, I think that apart from the people who are explicitly affiliated with her, it changes a lot, but not a lot at the same time, because you know, people are going to grieve differently when someone's like clearly murdered versus someone who's been like missing for a set period of time. I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that there's a quite a few of the same people are in both shots of the double R, but they're all in different shots. And to me, that's like to me that just reaffirms the idea that there's these small, minute things that are changing in both realities. But I think the fact that it shows it back and forth, and then there's that foreboding soundtrack that kicks in during the credits. It went over my head the first time, but each time I do the rewatch, I think that, oh, this is with two realities, and this is like basically Cooper's at fault. And to come back to Jerry, he got caught up in the woods at the worst possible time.
Absolutely correct. I couldn't agree with you more. And the fact that like it could very well be an editing, not a mistake, because I think Dwayne Dunham mentioned it, but I think like, I mean, Lynch obviously approved every single frame, every shot, that they could have just stayed on one shot, one side, and because the credits just roll, nothing happens, that he deliberately did that. He's the co-creator of this series, this narrative. There's a reason why I think he did it. And it wasn't just like, oh, whatever. It's like we needed the extra shot, you know, whatever. That we'll have all these podcasters come up with these theories. Like, that's not a Lynch like works or whatever. I totally agree with you. I think there's a schism there. I think there was a, and especially with that sound, the sound design over, it's this menacing. I think it's, I don't know if it's the Windham Earl theme. I don't know what it is, but it's like it's one of the darker themes. And playing over the diner. You know, I mean, come on. I mean, so yes, there's a lot of stuff happening at that particular moment that I agree with what you're saying. And I think you're absolutely correct that Jerry, and I think that that's something that would make Lynch and Frost laugh. That, okay, Jerry gets kind of caught up for like whatever, this minimal amount of screen time. Jerry's getting caught up in this. You know, I just, and I could see Lynch or Frost going like, yeah, I would love to see Jerry, like, actually, you know, with a beard and whatever this outfit he's wearing, running, like high stepping, like out of the way. Like I could see that they've got like this kind of, I would say juvenile sense of humor, but if you read the script for One Saliva Bubble, the movie that made them both laugh, and just their sense of humor. I mean, it's like, it's unique. And I think they make each other laugh. I can see them putting this peripheral character in this setting, which has maybe a larger thematic, you know, meaning to it.
I think this is probably a good way to wind down, because coming back to part 16, it's the last time we really see Jerry Horn. And it's like very vaguely and indirectly, but it's almost a full circle of when we first see him, because I was mentioning how when we see him in episode 2, where he's very funny, but there's this dark foreboding atmosphere that kind of leads into One-Eyed Jax. Something similar kind of happens with part 16, because it's a very dark intro with Dean Hurley's Night Electricity theme is playing as Mr. C and Richard Horn are just driving down. Of course, you know, it's like that famous driving in the middle of night, no lights, like you don't know where you're going. But then you cut to Jerry and he's doing like this goofy run. And, you know, I know a lot of people laugh at the bad binoculars, but to me, I think that's, I wouldn't say it's upsetting, but I would definitely say that it's like in the middle of Jerry having like a legitimate meltdown. And I've kind of wondered if there was ever any reason of him seeing his great nephew just like die this brutal, horrible death. And Jerry Richard Horn is not a good person, but for Jerry to see his, you know, unknowingly see his great nephew like just explode like that, maybe there isn't actually a significance to it, but I have wondered that, you know, this is someone of his who he's related to, that maybe he was meant to see this and he doesn't know why. And I'll be honest, I sure as hell don't know why either.
Right. I don't know if there's like a definitive answer.
I mean, that would be my guess that Lynch and Frost, with this, there's an explicit, I think they just like how certain things like unfold, but I don't think it's coincidental that when he comes out of the woods and he finally sees someone, that it's his niece's son, his grandnephew or whatever. And if you think about it, like, you know, chronologically, like Audrey had that child while she was recovering in the hospital. And the reason why she was in the hospital is because she was at the bank when it blew up. Why was she at the bank? She was at the bank because her father told her civil disobedience was stop Ghostwood. It wasn't something that she actively did on her own. So you think the reality of Richard existing is, you know, those steps, you know, and it's like the sins of her father and her uncle, like they're bad guys. I mean, Jerry's a bad guy. Ben's a bad guy. I mean, they've got positive qualities to them. They're not evil. You know, they're not true villains, but they're not, come on. Ben's a horrible family, you know, man. Jerry's not a great uncle or anything. So, you know, and it's like, it's, I'm gonna say reality, but like Jerry seeing his niece's son die and not know it, not recognize it, that's almost like that's dark, you know, like he probably will never know that. We know it. And that's like, you know, and he'll never like reconcile that. But if you think about like the steps or whatever, it's like Ben and Jerry did a lot of bad things to a lot of people. And I think that maybe this is something Lynch and Frost talked about, is that they still continue to affect people as we age, even as those individuals, you know, maybe like mellow out and chill. And, you know, that's like, that's part of that reality, that harsh reality. And like, that's just me like reading into it, but that's like maybe one interpretation of it. I agree with the binoculars. I think that's more kind of like a visual kind of thing, like kind of like when Lynch reverses shots, like he's looking at the binoculars the wrong way. So they're probably looking very far away, the distortion kind of, you know, heightening that. So I don't feel sadness, but if I think about it, like, that's how I would feel. I'd feel like sad for everyone, for like Audrey, even Richard Horn. He shouldn't exist. He's a bad kid. He's probably one of the worst characters in The Return. He shouldn't exist. And it all kind of like filters down from Ben and Jerry, you know, this, you know, and they're like supposedly like the important people in this community. Well, they're kind of, I would say the worst people, but, you know, kind of, yeah, because of how they use their position and their money and whatnot to manipulate and use individuals, even their family members.
And I think one thing that might build off of this, you know, even though we can't really have a definitive answer on why Jerry saw Richard Horn die this horrible death, but it is worth addressing that, you know, I was mentioned that when he's in the woods, it's broad daylight. It looks like it's relatively the same time each day, but then he gets out, it's night. I mean, obviously, you know, part 16 starts at very late night or even early morning, if you prefer. But I think that the fact that we see a sudden change of time after all this, after at least like 8 to 10 parts of Jerry lost in the woods, I think that's something that's like worth mentioning in as we close in on his final scene.
Yeah, no, it is.
I mean, that contrast, because you're right. I mean, that cold open of part 7, I think it opened, like, you got the credits and Julie Cruz falling, and then you get this shot, this static shot of Jerry in the woods, and he's just kind of like almost staring at us. And, you know, that's the beginning of it. He's high, and the banter with Jerry, and there's a great line where I think he says, like, someone stole my car. And then he hears Ben say it, and he says, like, Jerry says, like, you say the same thing. I mean, that stuff that happened that you experience when you're on drugs or whatever. But Jerry's been getting high for a long time. This isn't like a bad strain. He's being affected by something externally. And the fact that you see him all in broad daylight, and then you contrast his final scene, like you said, Lynch sets it up with that foreboding, like that classic Lynch POV driving shot, which he used to great effect in many of his movies, and The Return. That, yeah, it's not, now it's dark. I mean, really, I mean, Twin Peaks, I don't want to get off on too many tangents here, but like, I'm a firm believer that Twin Peaks ends very dark, especially after reading John Bourne's book, which I think, by the way, is great and probably the closest interpretation of what, you know, probably can be a legitimate theory. He gets like closest to it, like at least from what I've heard or read. And I'm pretty sure that, like, you know, it's dark in his opinion too. It's dark. So it makes sense. I mean, there's a little bit of like a part 17 where kind of the Dougie Cooper storyline, kind of like, it's kind of, you know, and he comes back home to Janie E. It's a home. It's kind of a happy ending. But no, this is the reason why Twin Peaks is so dark with these characters, because it's a dark time. And Jerry Horn, periphery character, you know, whatever. You said it great. He ends in darkness. You know, he sees a horrible family member die that he'll never be able to kind of like, you know, understand or even know. And I don't think it's a coincidence that it's happening at night.
And, you know, for a character like Jerry, it's kind of crazy to think we're ending the episode on a deceptively dark note. But was there anything you want to say before we sign off for this?
Yeah, it got really dark here,
didn't it? Yeah. I mean, after talking about like Uncle Jerry's here and all these line readings, and now it's like, wow, it's all somber and foreboding and tying Jerry into like part 18 and the darkness. No, you're right. So, no, I, like I said, for me personally, Jerry is a fun character. And I thank you for asking me to, you know, come onto your show and discuss him, because he's someone that, you know, me and, you know, Murphy still, not him specifically, but just, you know, the scenes with Ben that we still refer to, you know, on the phone or, you know, whatever, we're together. We just love these lines. So it's been great talking about him with you. But even, but I haven't had a conversation like this ever. Like, I'm not talking about the in-depth of Jerry Horn character ever in my life. So talking to him with you brings out all these things. It's another great thing about Twin Peaks, is if you can find someone who's a fan and talk about it, like, not all, it's not like most shows where it's like, it's kind of cut and dry. You discover things, and I've discovered things about Jerry talking to you, even like in preparation of this. And it's like, so, you know, another, you know, reason to be grateful for you is like, you know, like now it's like, you know, Jerry's more full in my head, but no, he's still a fun, lovable guy. And I think I would just want to end it with just like one of his great lines. I've probably said them all. I don't know what I'll say. Oh, I just came up with it. Bunk beds, one of my favorite lines. I love the bunk beds bit.
Now, I think there's one thing I came from this is that, you know, you were talking about the intuitive nature. We were talking about how the merits of like whether it's being a lawyer or the marijuana legalization. But I think that looking at like that conversation, and I'm thinking of like the dream line that he says in early season 2, is that I wonder if his intuitiveness, if it either worked for him or against him at the end. And because there's such an ambiguity, I couldn't even say for sure, but I just know that from what we see in part 16, what we hear in part 17, that in that moment, it's certainly working against him.
It is working against him.
And I think that that's like, that's kind of a shift, like that, that whole second season, that I think that's the second episode of the second season. I mean, there's a big tonal shift, and, you know, it's because they're trying to get to the reveal, which they didn't want to reveal or whatever. But I mean, dreams have always played a big part in Twin Peaks and David Lynch's narratives and whatnot. But that specific thing, I never see. That's a, another thing, you know, benefit of this conversation is that for me, it was like, it was just kind of a, not a funny line, you know, because it's he just said, yeah, please kill Leland, but it plays in, it has a much deeper meaning. And I didn't think about it connecting to Jerry in season three. And now you bringing that up, now I'm thinking about that. And I'm thinking like, okay, so intuitively, not intuitively, I mean, I don't have any, my guess is, I don't think that Lynch and Frost connected that line to Jerry in whatever season three or whatever, but I can see that somehow Jerry being kind of a fun character, and the fact that Ghostwood was such a big part of his arc in, you know, along with Ben and others, that when they came to write him, that they put him kind of in his own hell. I mean, really, I mean, isn't Ghostwood now like a correctional facility, according to Mark Frost?
Yeah, in the final dossier, it's something akin to like a very poorly run prison. And it's I forgot the name of the warden at the prison that Mr. C and Ray are in, but it was something he worked at previously.
Oh, that's right. That was the connection.
Yeah. So that's another thing we didn't talk about with the woods and the kind of the ominous nature, you know, more so in season three, is that off camera, apparently, at least to Mark Frost, there's a prison, you know, nearby or whatever. And what is confinement, the theme that we're talking about, being stuck. So yeah, it all plays into it. I just don't know if there was any kind of grand scheme or design by Lynch and Frost with Jerry in the woods, other than having some fun with it. And also it playing more so than some of the other, maybe like kind of characters on the periphery. This one, I think, like, you know, I'm not saying it tied into Cooper, but like, I personally can read into some things if I want to, with the themes of Cooper's plight in the lodge and being stuck and the woods and whatnot. But yeah,
I guess I'll say that, you know, David Patrick Kelly, even if we're just looking at the most like surface level, rudimentary way possible, it was probably the most David Patrick Kelly performance we could have asked for. And even just that is enough to make me happy.
Yeah, no, I'm grateful. This is like my favorite David Patrick Kelly role. I'm grateful that he got the part, and I'm grateful for his performance. And he will live on forever. His character will live on forever in my mind. And when I watch it and talk about Twin Peaks. So yes, I'm very grateful. As someone also as you know, being a fan of Twin Peaks for so long or whatever, that he had an incredible fashion sense in 1990. Don't you agree?
Yeah. Oh no, it's definitely a cut above like everyone else in that show.
It was different. Wasn't he the outlier? Like everyone had this kind of weird hybrid of like, I don't know, 1980s and 50s, but Jerry had a very contemporary outfit and he kind of stood out, which I thought made him more interesting as well.
I think it was the hair and the glasses that did it for the original series. But yeah, no, David Patrick Kelly finds a way to stand out, like no matter what project he's in.
And don't forget the smoked cheese pig.
Since we're winding down, you know, was there any social media you like to plug or anything where people can find you?
I do Twitter for
fun. We might do a podcast when maybe David Lynch has something else, or if there's something with Twin Peaks, but like, you know, we've got other things going on, and it's just a joy to be, that's really the Twitter thing is just to kind of stay, I would say active, but like, you know, for myself, I love Twin Peaks. That's an outlet for me. And it was an opportunity that, and Colin saw my page or saw a tweet, and you know, it led to this. So I'm grateful for that. So no, I'm just a fan. I love talking about Twin Peaks, and I'm grateful for Colin for this opportunity. So thank you. Together.